She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And thanks to all of you that write to me and call me and let me know that we did give you important things to think about and make up your own mind about where you stand on the guests we interview and the issues we addressed. Just let me say that our show today is made possible to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group. They are doing their share and showing they care through the important work of their Community Green team. We thank them for their support and for all they do to make our community and our planet stronger and more sustainable. Thank you, Chapman. So the name of our show today is Shaping a New World. And with me for the next hour is someone that really has a vision for that. It's really what he's all about. His name is Greg Watson. He is the Director for Policy and Systems Design at the Schumacher Center for New Economics and leader of the Cuba-U.S. Agroecology Network. Just a whole exciting bunch of stuff that's going on there. Isn't that so articulate? A bunch of stuff. So Greg was formerly Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Food and Agriculture and also served as Massachusetts Senior Advisor for Clean Energy Technology and has had a long career and a very impressive career of exemplary public service. So welcome, Greg. This has been a long time coming. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for inviting me.
We can't wait. I have lots of questions, so I want to just get on with it. So that everybody knows, I met Greg at a Bioneers conference last October and came back, and I will tell you, it's one of the top of the people on the list. I said to Kelly, my amazing show producer, we've got to get Greg, and we did. So thank you, my friend.
Okay. He's very kind.
Talk about the Schumacher Center for a New Economics, starting with its mission. It's a really powerful mission.
It is, and the Schumacher that the organization is named after, for those who may not be familiar, is E.F. Schumacher, who was a British economist. And wrote a book, a seminal book, back in the, I think it was in the 70s, called Small is Beautiful, Economics as if People Mattered. And he was one of the first people to challenge sort of the traditional economic system. And this is right around the same time that the, appropriate technology movement, the Earth Day movement was taking place, where people were sensing that there was a need to, in fact, change the world. And rather than just sort of talking about or at least stating what was wrong and what the problems were, there was a group of folks who were actually suggesting alternative ways of meeting our basic needs. And that included, you know, the organic agriculture movement, the renewable energy movement. But I think fundamentally, you know, for someone to say, let's rethink the way that we view economics, was pretty startling to a lot of people. And that's what E.F. Schumacher did, and the Schumacher Center picking up on his themes. And that included things like looking at land ownership, looking at sustainable agriculture and an appropriate technology, and how these different approaches to meeting our needs could be scaled to human individual and community needs, but also was sensitive to the ecological integrity of the planet. And so this was really sort of earth-shaking, and the Schumacher Center is really taking the concepts that were developed by E.F. Schumacher and applying them to communities to empower them to take some control over their own economics and bring it down to community scale.
And, you know, it's always interesting for me doing the research for so many shows on different content, how I learn from what the content is on websites. And I say that because it's important that people like me that are mainstream, that are not scientists or economists, can go and really learn. And some of the words on the website, I understand when it is written, architecture for a new economy, and what it might look like. So that to me was a really great and practical way to explain what that means. So can you just talk a little bit about what the architecture for a new economy looks like and what it means?
Sure. And again, if you begin with who owns the land and how was that land held.
Right.
And I think the idea of community land trusts, where communities really sort of say, you know, rather than everything having to be looked at in terms of private ownership, although private, you know, you have private ownership within those structures, but I think it, you know, making land available and accessible and involving the community and making decisions about how that land is used so that it is in fact in concert with the environment and what I will describe in just a second as a new economics. But it also means, you know, how do we relate and exchange with one another? One of the, I guess, probably the most revolutionary developments and artifacts of the Schumacher Center has been the development of its own local currency. And it's sort of interesting, the development of local currency, most people are just amazed that it was done, that the fact that there is a local currency circulating. In this case, well, the Schumacher Center for New Economics is located in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. That's the western part of of Massachusetts, in an area called the Berkshires. Berkshires, and that's really, you know, it is a place-based sort of organization. It really tries to practice what it preaches. So it's located and it's working in those areas. So this currency is circulating within the Berkshires communities. And I think the most important thing, the most about the local currency, certainly it's amazing that it exists. But I think the most important thing is that people tried it. They raised the question, can we print our own currency?
Yes.
Right? Because usually, if someone proposed that, the first thing that would come to mind, you can't do it.
And
then it stops there.
And you can do it, yes.
Right. It stops right there. But you don't, you have to pursue the assumptions. Well, why? What is currency? What is it all about? You know, what are the legalities around it? And I think that if you can do that with currency, you can do with other aspects of the economy. And a little bit of history will teach you that, well, local scrip existed for bartering back, you know, during the Great Wars, right? Because, again, people had to take control of their own lives because the government was preoccupied with, let's just say, larger things, right? And so the responsibilities that most people felt could only reside in the government became within the reach of the communities, and they had to assume those responsibilities, and that's a very empowering sort of, right? It's a very, very empowering when that happens. So the architecture is built around land. It's built around concepts of community-supported agriculture, right? And so if farmers are having a difficult time making a living, now again, I'm just going to preface this, right? Because when we talk about there's a myth that floats around there about the inefficiency of small farms, and that's the reason why we've seen a decline in the number of small farms and concentration of larger and larger farms. But that actually was a conscious decision by the government back in the 70s to actually remove folks from the land, consolidate farms, and send people off into the cities to develop, you know, industrial and high-tech industries. But it's not something that's inherent in agriculture, right? Something as noble and as important as growing food, to then say that it can't exist because it's inefficient, there seems to be something wrong. And so, but it's a tough business. So what the new economics says is it possible that consumers and farmers can work together and share the risk and share the benefits and bounties of agriculture? And that means that consumers actually invest in the farms in the off season and sort of say, farmer, we're going to help you buy your seeds and prepare your land, and we're going to make an investment in your farm, and without even knowing what it is that we're going to receive, other than, you know, hopefully it's going to be a bounty. And so these folks sort of form an essence, which is a cooperative with their farmers. And so that's a very different way of thinking about agriculture and relationship between farmers and consumers. It's also based on this concept of import substitution, right? So we live in communities. We know that many things that we cannot produce ourselves, maybe because of, you know, whatever, the resources that are available, if it's a matter of food, because of the climate. But there are many, many things that we import that we take for granted. It's the only way that we can get them.
Right.
But Jane Jacobs talked a lot about this concept of local economies, building local economies, and maybe starting with saying, what is it? What are the goods and services that we all need and are essential? And how many of those that we import from somewhere else could actually be part of our own local economy?
And go back.
So that begins the architecture.
It begins the architecture. And go back a little bit to, I love talking about the concept of local currency. You actually have something that's in place back there, as far as I know from the website, called Berkshares. And it's not been a little bit of circulation. It's over 7 million. And I had on my show very, very early on Bernard Leotar and Jackie Dunn, who wrote a book, Rethinking Money. And it was a big eye-opener to me about where local currencies have actually brought cities, one city, I wish I could remember the name of it, in South America, back on its feet without the government producing money that was based on debt. They started a local currency, and now it's a thriving metropolis. And I like I said, I wish I could remember, but talk about why does the local currency versus a centralized currency help with that architecture of a new economy?
Yes, that's a good question. And one of the ways that it really helps is because local currencies provide information about the local economy. The currency that we have in our pockets, and most of us have, really is based on concepts like gross domestic product and the federal system
and
that
debt.
It doesn't really sort of reflect what's going on locally. As a matter of fact, let's face it, the GDP soars and improves when there are disasters, right? Because the big companies that deal with those sort of things come in, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing, at least if you only look at it with respect to something called the gross, and maybe that's an appropriate word, domestic product, right? Because it doesn't really say what's going on locally. How are we actually really doing? So and it doesn't really sort of contribute to sort of building the local economy.
Right.
You know, the local currency, you print it. And by the way, the local currency, the one thing that you have to do is make sure that it doesn't look like the federal dollars, because then you're kind of infringing upon counterfeiting. So you don't want to do that. But this is all very legal if you do it within the right guidelines. And if you're in our local currency, and the Berkshires really have on their faces reflect the local heroes, people who lived in the Berkshires, and DuBose and Herman Melville and Norman Rockwell and Karen Van Inn, who started the first community-supported agriculture farm, I think, in the country. We're going to take credit for it, so I'm on. I can say that now. Someone
wants
to challenge it.
You can do it.
Okay, someone can challenge that later. But I do think it was the birth of community-supported agriculture. So you've got these bills in your pocket now, and you go out and you're going to shop. And you can only use these, obviously, these bills in your region. And if you've got them in your pocket and you're looking, not that people wouldn't do it anyway, but one of the things that it does inspire or stimulate is, can I get it locally? I've got these dollars in my pocket, and where can I buy? And
yes.
Who participates?
Yes.
Who participates in these in this program? Well, it's the local grocery store will participate if they can take your dollars and if they can then use it to buy what they need, right? What are their inputs? And are there local companies or businesses around, whether it's services or goods, that all can provide them with what they need, and will they accept Berkshire? So it becomes sort of an organizing project, right? And then inspired by this concept of community building strength in community, and most importantly, and once again, let's get to architecture. Maybe this is some more like human architecture or whatever. Can we keep the dollar circulating within our community? Can we prevent as much as possible dollars flowing out to buy something that could stay within the community, because we have businesses that do provide it, and then we've got this incentive, this currency that says use them, right, and buy within. So that's really, you really do need somewhat of a diverse economic landscape, right? Because you do want to make sure that those who are using them are going to be able to use them in turn to buy some things that they need. But it really has taken off, and it's a very, very exciting concept. And it's all part of the import substitution, right? I mean, again, it's systems. I mean, I have this vague title, right? System design. Someone said, what does that mean? What does that mean?
It means a really big job.
It's a really big job.
Really big job.
Deal with interconnections. And if you can make the right connections and create these sustainable systems, you really do create holes that are greater than the sum of their parts.
And it's really interesting to me, because we, in what I do, there's a lot of trade involved, which is somewhat of a local currency. And I think with that connection that you are so striving for, there where there's common interests and there's systems that are mutually beneficial, then you have those connections, and your where you go to get your hair done matters. And if you're part of a food co-op, it matters. And the stores that you frequent, they become about relationships, and you're more invested. And I don't really want to slam big box stores because sometimes I have to go into them, but it's a very different experience. There's not an investment. It's more of an, you know, you just have to go and get something and you're in and out. But, you know, with restaurants and everything, where you buy your office supplies and all of those things create a stronger social capital for everyone.
Absolutely. And a sense of a real sense of community.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you know you're in this together, right? Because we're doing this. And there's no question. Absolutely.
So when you're talking about, I read this wonderful quote that I found on the website. And it said, it was Andrew Kimbrell, who is at the Center for Food Safety, I think, now. To create a new economics, we must first fall in love with its vision. So there's a difference between a mission and a vision. For you, Greg Watson, and for the Schumacher Center, what is the vision? To me, it's a very important question of what are you asking us to look at so that we can all get excited and help create this new a new economic?
Well, let me speak for myself first, because I think the vision, and I think you actually alluded to it a little earlier, even in talking about the mission of the program, is not to sort of teach people what to think, but how to think, right? I mean, that to me, that's a Buckminster Fuller quote. Bucky Fuller was my guru, and the whole idea is, do we know what our options are? And are we trapped now in systems that we know are just not right? They're not equitable. They're not in, you know, there's the environment. As a matter of fact, I was asking folks a question the other day. Can you name a system that you think is operating the way that it was, that it's supposed to?
I mean, and did they come up system. With anything?
They were scratching their heads. And
so sad.
You know, but seriously, and you know, and it's because things are out of kilter. And, you know, one of the things that we sort of fall prey to is the fact that there's nothing we can do about it, because that's the way that things work. And so when you look at something, as I mentioned a little earlier, as I would say fundamental, but also something that seems to a certain extent beyond question, the assumptions underlying it beyond question, is our economic system. And as a matter of fact, I would even go a little further to say that you know, it is praised as being obviously one of the, you know, again, one of the reasons for this country's preeminence in the world, I'll use in quotes, is because of the, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but because of our economic system. And clearly it has done some good things, and it has proven itself to be viable in many ways, but there are some problems. There really are some problems. And I think that when we talk about a new economics, we're not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're saying, right? I mean, I think that's important. Can we at least examine the assumptions and then understand that there is a, and here's my vision, okay? I took the like circuitous route to get to it, but you know, can we actually, this is mine, and we'll get to Schumacher's, but can I just do my personal one?
Yes,
just for a second?
And I'm following you, so you're taking it to a really good, it's like, no, what you're saying is so heartfelt, and so it makes so much sense.
And can we create a world that works for everyone? And I mean, that's sort of, you know, that a vision is something that you set out there.
I love that. Like, you know, that is a world that works for everyone.
And then that's a combination. That's a little bit of Schumacher, and that's a little bit of Buckminster Fuller. But we do know how to make a world that works for everyone. And the issue is, do we have access and understand the right? Do we have access to the right tools, the right means? And they do exist. Now, I'm 67 years old, and back in the 1970s, there was a publication that you're probably too young to remember, and it was called The Whole Earth Catalog. And
Greg,
remember the Whole
I'm
Earth Catalog?
65, so yeah, I'm right there with you, bud. So not a problem.
You're right there.
I know when you met me, I look so much younger.
You look so much. You do. Right. You do.
Just, but here, it's okay. Lie to me on air. I love it.
Okay, you love it. And remember the subtitle of that publication, Access to Tools.
Access to Tools.
It was access to tools. And these are sort of what Ivan Illich would call the tools for conviviality, right? Tools that are accessible by individuals and communities.
Greg Watson,
right?
And hold that thought. We are up on the first break. I cannot believe
all
it.
Right.
Everybody stay here with me. I'm hanging on every word. I hope you are all too. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And that's precisely what we're talking about today. I am so pleased to have with us for this hour Greg Watson, Director for Policy and System Design at the Schumacher Center for a New Economics and leader of the Cuba-U.S. Agroecology Network. Greg was formerly commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Food and Agriculture and also served as Massachusetts Senior Advisor for Clean Energy Technology and has a long and most impressive and passionate career of exemplary service. Greg, thanks for being with us. And we were talking about your vision and segueing to the vision of the Schumacher Center.
Yes. And sort of that whole era, right? Schumacher with, again, the concept being, again, an economics that that really not just includes but embraces people and other living creatures in its within its framework, right? Again, it's not just sort of a bottom line, not just sort of the quantitative part, but it's an economics that also speaks to values and to qualities. And again, in order to really sort of make that happen, and to make that vision real, you've got to know what your options are, the options are that are available to you, and the tools. Now, one of the past lives that you didn't mention in my little bio was a stent.
We did not go into past lives.
Was a stent at a place called the New Alchemy Institute on Cape Cod. And I bring that up just because, again, in terms of helping people understand what their options are, before I went there, and this was a research, 12-acre research facility on Cape Cod that was founded by a couple of marine biologists, John Todd, Bill McLarney, and Nancy Jack Todd, who was a writer and activist. And in the same vein as Schumacher, where Schumacher was focused on economics, this group was focused on sort of the technology that provide our basic needs of food, energy, shelter, and water. And what they wanted to do too was to just challenge our assumptions. And one of the things that happened there was it was an experimental farm. But it was the first time that I realized, for instance, and let's ground this a little bit, that it is possible to produce enough food on a tenth of an acre of land to feed 13 people three vegetable portions a day for a year with no chemical fertilizers,
wow,
pesticides, or herbicides. Now, and rather than it just being theoretical, and let's just say, they did it, right? Raised beds and companion planting and composting and mulching and rotational planting and preserving. And so it was looking at the whole system. We also realized that in Massachusetts, we could build a passive solar greenhouse that could not only produce food year-round, but could actually support fruiting bananas and fig trees. And it's not to say that we want to grow bananas and figs necessarily in Massachusetts, but to demonstrate that we could do these things without reliance upon the expensive and environmentally harmful chemical and energy intensive input. So my passion, if you will, is derived from knowing that these things are possible, right? And let me get to Schumacher, but what became sort of apparent is that they didn't appear to question, and the wall that we kept running into is that, well, Greg, that's all well and good. You can grow the food there. You don't need chemical pesticides, herbicides. You can produce energy from the wind. You can produce it from the sun. You can grow fish in these tanks, but it's not economically viable.
Right? Such
and that
a good
was
point.
Always
like, such a good point. I mean, I think it's still one of the big challenges.
It's not it, and it clearly is one of the challenges. And so, and again, so the question is: so does that mean that? And here's where you've got to have one of those aha moments, right? Does that mean that our ideas and our concepts and these technologies and approaches to sustainability are wrong, or could it be that the economics is wrong? And so you always assume, right, that because the organic agriculture and because the wind turbines and because the solar panels don't fit neatly into the economic system and give you the return on investment that the investors are looking for, that that's the problem. When in fact, could it be that what it is that we're valuing and how we value and you know the context for this is the thing that we need to reexamine? And I know that sounds really formidable and it sounds like you got to be kidding me. How can we do that? But that is one of the that's the mission of Schumacher, to say the root of a lot of our problems and a lot of the ills that we're facing has to do with the current economic system and the context that it creates.
And the current model. And I could not agree with you more. And it's what, right. Even when you talk about, I'm sure you know that the fashion industry is the second most polluting industry in the world.
Yeah.
Well, one of the
yeah.
problems with that is exactly what you're talking about. It's overconsumption. It's buying too much stuff. Why do we need 7 or 10 or 15 pairs of shoes? So it is relooking or rethinking our values and the accumulation of stuff. And you're getting to the core of what, to me, you're combining the theoretical research on economics with the application and what kind of grassroots things have to change. That's what, the Schumacher Center is talking about.
Absolutely, and your example of the fashion industry is right on the mark. But also think about, and this gets us, brings us back full circle too. Think about traditional, at least the industrial agriculture, which is one of the major contributors or generators of greenhouse gases.
Right there, right up at the top.
So here we are. Yeah. We've got a system. It's polluting groundwater. It's sucking up so much water, and that the Colorado River doesn't drain into the Gulf. It's also spewing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere
and hurting the workers,
driving small family farms, which out of business. And so there's something wrong with the picture. And it's not a slam on agriculture. It's not the what, it's the how, right? It's how we're doing it.
It is the how. And it's kind of, jumping ahead for where I want to go, but this is what we do on Mrs. Green's World. We have a great conversation. So it's when you're talking about it's a safer economic model, and I mean that because I think mm-hmm. looking ahead with climate change being the number one threat to our planet every day in every way, you're talking about greater regional food security. That's going to mean something really soon. It already means stuff in other places throughout the world, but the relationship between food security and food sovereignty. I'd love to take you there for a little bit so you can explain that. We need to get into that's all part of the Cuba versus U.S. agroecology network, but it is relevant to Cuba and what's going on there, what we're learning, and what's going on here. Food security, as the drought continues to spread, and all of those things that we have to look forward to, talk about food security and food sovereignty as it fits into a new economy.
Sure, I will. And your points also sort of suggest we also really do need to sort of rethink how we teach history and what we teach in history. It's sort of we get a little better sense of how we got to where we are, and because in some cases it's not because there were necessarily a bunch of evil people, whatever.
Right.
Sometimes
exactly.
Things happen out of necessity, and these were the tools you had. You had available to you at the time. Now, some cases, those did get distorted. There's no
right.
question
in
of that.
Cases,
but I just
they just happened. It evolved.
It just evolved. And, one of those things was, again, if you think about the assumptions about, again, food production. Now, I live in Massachusetts. We're a very small state. And I do remember going, when I was commissioner, going to one of my first meetings of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, where all the commissioners and secretaries got together, and I was brand new, and I walked into it, and it was the only, you know, African-American commissioner or secretary of agriculture in the entire group. And so, and I was late for the meeting, and there was a little silence as I came and stormed into the room. And I sat down next to a gentleman, stately gentleman, and I'm pretty sure he was from one of the Carolinas, right? And my memory is, but he kind of pulled my chain a little bit, and he goes, "So tell me there, son, what do you grow in Massachusetts?" And I kind of fumbled. I said, "Well, we grow everything. We grow apples. We grow cranberries. We grow lettuce, tomatoes. And by the way, those are things that the U.S. Department of Agriculture calls specialty crops." Right? The things that we eat, those are specialty crops. The commodities are the soybeans and the corn used for the grain and the wheat and the and all. But, and anyway, getting back to what he says, and then he said, he looked at me and he had a twinkle in his eye, and he said, "You do know, son, that had this country been settled from the west coast to the east, y'all would have been a national park." And I thought about it for a second. And, you know, but he may have been right.
Oh, my gosh, that's
no one
priceless.
Probably in the right may have said, "We're going to turn this into a densely populated state with this very short growing season." Now, I set that up only to say that, you know, when I became commissioner, and by the way, I was commissioner twice and with a 20-year sort of period in between. But the first time, Massachusetts was experiencing this incredible decline. We had since the beginning at the end of the Second World War to the mid-70s, we were losing 10,000 acres of farmland and 200 farm businesses a year going out. And so people had written off Massachusetts agriculture. And the reason was, they said, "Look, we're a small state. We're high-tech oriented. We have a very short growing season."
Right.
And look at California. Or, you know, in South America, the other parts of the country. But at that point, it was really year-round warm weather, flat, fertile land. You know what? they can do it, and we'll divvy up the responsibilities.
Right.
And by the way, back then, energy was very, very cheap.
Yes.
So the
yes.
fact that it was being transported 3,000 miles, then so that whole thing. And were we aware of that it all depended upon, you know, again, these vast subsidies to support the water extraction? It did not. So now we fast forward to 2016, and there's no question the most important issue that overhangs everything these days is climate change. And, you know, the impact, when you think about all the impacts, as you mentioned earlier, there are other countries that are already, you know, feeling those impacts. I think we are, too. And sometimes it seems a little cruel that sometimes it seems the first impacts seem to happen to those either countries or communities, right, that can least, you know, protect themselves against it. But that just seems to be the way that it is. But the food is very, the food production and agriculture is very vulnerable, right? I mean, all it takes is a slight change in precipitation and temperature to really throw things off. So we're flirting with that sort of that disaster. And so the idea of how do we prepare ourselves, how do we anticipate those things, and what do we need to do? And so there are two concepts that sort of jump up at people. And one is, you know, and they're very similar, but they aren't the same. And one is food security, which is, I think we talk about a lot about here. And the other is food sovereignty. And food security is pretty much, it focuses just on the what. That is, we have to figure out ways that we can ensure that we're going to be able to provide ourselves with food over, you know, and that could include everything from, but it could be high tech, it could be, you know, genetic engineering, it could be seed banks that are planted, you know, where somebody collects all the germplasm, puts them in some vault, you know, somewhere, and says, "We now own this, and when things really get bad, we'll be able to pull them out of there." But that's a lot different than food sovereignty, and food sovereignty is got some values associated with it. It still talks about food security, but it talks about it in terms of the rights of people, right, to healthy and culturally appropriate foods, and that are developed with environmentally sound methods, and that they're part of the decision making as to how that's going to happen, right? So it's an empowering, it's an inclusive process. but it's embedded in that is that it is, it really does talk about producing healthy, safe, culturally appropriate foods, not saving those seeds or monopolizing agriculture so that we're only growing about 1 or 2% of the foods that could be grown and that we have to adapt to our palates to, because that's what is presented to us by the large, right, the concerns
right.
that now
right.
produce the food, as opposed to, well, you know what, when it's local, when it's culturally appropriate, that means that even in Massachusetts we can grow some foods that we didn't know that we could grow, that are important to our growing immigrant population, for instance, right? But and those sort of things start to play into it, so that people do feel that they're part of the community and they feel healthy and they feel that they are acknowledged and they're respected. So there's a sort of all those things. So food sovereignty really embraces all those sorts of concepts and values, as opposed to just a blunt food security. We're going, and the food security, by the way, sort of suggests a little bit of us versus them and a little bit of survivalist sort of mentality, right? We're going to like, and so there's a difference. There is a qualitative difference. And that's what sort of the sustainable agriculture, that's what the new economics would really certainly say, that's the framework for this, is that we're going to try to promote that concept of sovereignty versus just plain old security, which is, and again, not that we do have to think in those terms. I think, you know, we're when we start talking about adaptation, and we are at that stage, right? You know, we've unfortunately procrastinated to the point where a lot of the options for mitigating the worst case scenarios of climate change may be sort of slipping through our fingers. And when
rather quickly.
And
yes.
as you know, when we adaptation is a very tricky thing, because this whole notion, what we're doing, we're not trying to save the earth, right? The earth is going to survive us. Gaia will survive us. We're trying to save ourselves.
Right.
I mean, I think that's clearly, and I happen to be a believer in trying to save ourselves, because I think that there are many important things that we could do. But when we try, when we continually back ourselves into a corner where now adaptation means we have to try to guess how nature is going to write the system, because nature will correct.
Right.
But we have no idea how that would happen. Right, because most of those in the position of power are linear thinkers, and one thing nature is not is linear.
Absolutely true, and sometimes
and so,
not always predictable.
Absolutely not
right.
predictable.
Rarely
because
predictable. Yeah,
rarely predictable, and so that's why adaptation is a very, very dangerous corner to back ourselves into entirely. I mean, we are in an adaptive mode, because we know we have to be, right? Because that's where we painted ourselves. So what are some of those examples of systems that have shown that you can create the possibilities and the context and the venues for truly sustainable agriculture that can lead to food sovereignty? And that's one of the reasons why we got attracted to Cuba for that and a number of other reasons.
And I cannot wait. We can start. We have a break in about another minute and a half. But
sure.
I think there's a couple of things that come to mind. It's a perfect segue for what the interesting, it's so timely, about what's going on with Cuba and the U.S. relations and the president's recent visit. So there's a lot of buzz interest going on, and what's going to happen in terms of the economics. I mean, I've been involved in some incredible conversations with people about even how they feel about it because of what it meant to them. So I think there's a real, road we can go down there for a little bit, because there's so much, to me, application for what we can look at in terms of, you know, providing affordable access to land for small farmers. And I don't know, I'm biased. I think it's the way we have to go. Instead of bigger, I think we need to go smaller in every way we can. So here's what I want to ask you when we come back.
Sure.
Here's
sure.
a segue that I think we can do, is I do want to talk about sustainable food systems and the delegation and what you're doing there. But I also want to make sure that we have time to talk a little bit about my heart space, which is where does the social justice picture fit into all of this and the concept of open agriculture? Because I want those to be part of people's conversation. And then you said something about, you know, the voice of the younger people when I was telling you about this conference for the Food Recovery Network. And what you said is it has to be a push, not a pull. Is that
a pull?
A pull, not
pull,
a push.
Not a push.
A pull,
yeah,
not a push. I have to
a
get
pull.
That right if I'm going to be
That's
quoting
right.
you. And really,
you want to be
the
pulled towards a positive vision.
Yes, yes, and not be being pushed. And that's just a vision I want to hold. So everybody, stay here with me. You're going to want to hear more. It's been a delightful interview so far with Greg Watson from the Schumacher Center for a New Economics. We'll be right back with lots more to share about Cuba and social justice as it relates to agriculture. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. This is the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And just my own plug for the announcement we had about considering becoming a sustainer. We are the PBS or the NPR of the radio networks, and we need your support. We appreciate your support. So visit our website and find out about how to become a sustainer. There's a choice for every budget. The name of our show today is Shaping a New World, and with me for this hour is Greg Watson, who's the Director for Policy and System Design at the Schumacher Center for a New Economics and leader of the Cuba-U.S. Agroecology Network, and we want to talk about that. And if you just Google Greg Watson, you can see what a journey he has had, an impressive career of exemplary public service, and I don't say that lightly, certainly is inspiring me. Lots of new learning going on. So, Greg, what about we talk a little bit about the Cuba-U.S. Agroecology Network and what that's all about?
You'll do that, but you know what? And let me, can I just preface that? Because I think you mentioned the social justice piece, because that is a good, it actually is a lead in to why I actually went to Cuba, that we went to Cuba the first time. And that is, and that was back in, it wasn't that long ago, and this has all happened in a whirlwind. It was in October of 2014.
14, yeah, I saw that.
Yes, and at that time, I was still commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Agriculture. And we were, we had initiated a statewide urban agriculture program. I think we were one of the first states to look at how could we, you know, sort of support, what could the state do in supporting this growing movement. Now, again, and here distinguishing a little bit of when we talk urban agriculture in Massachusetts, urban agriculture could include backyard gardens, community gardens, a whole bit of growing food, but we made the distinction and actually sometimes use the term urban farming, because we were actually interested in could there be commercial farming within the city limits. And again, I think even Jane Jacobs would argue that that agriculture actually originated in cities and then moved outside and then sort of became larger in a rural effort. But one of the things we found that there were a lot of communities that were, you know, the term of art that's used these days is, you know, where they're food deserts, right? Areas where local low-income communities had no access to fresh, nutritious food. They were, you know, supermarkets were not nearby. Grocery stores weren't there. Maybe bodegas, but they didn't have pretty much, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. And so we were searching for a solution or solutions to that problem, and which is a, you know, issue about social justice and social inequity. But one of the solutions was to try to attract supermarkets to these communities, and that's a tough sell because, again, the bottom line usually rules, and not more, you know, again, sort of social concerns or social priorities. But that's when sort of the notion of urban agriculture, food production, could we produce food closer? You know, that was one of the things I'll get to Cuba. So that was one of the things that we wanted to do, was to say, could there be both increased food production and maybe job creation if we could talk about commercial farming? And I'll get back to this. I will get to Cuba, but I think that
it's laying the groundwork. I mean, it's so important to understand where the origins of this came from and why we're doing this.
Absolutely. And so when, you know, this notion that you said, but what do we know about urban agriculture? And then really, we racked our brains. Now, at that time, I was sitting on, I was commissioner of agriculture, but sitting on the board of the Schumacher Center. And that's when I was excited about our program. But then the question came up, but where are you looking to for examples? You know, who's done the success? That is this urban farming, this urban agriculture. And I knew just enough to be dangerous and said, Cuba.
That's great.
A little bit of knowledge is the dangerous
right. thing.
Well, in this case, it turned out to be very fortuitous, because Susan Witt, the director, you know, took that and said, well, you know what, then you should go see what they're doing. And the long story short, she was able to pull together a delegation and get funding for us to go and take a look at, and the title of our delegation was to go take a look at Cuba's sustainable food systems. Now, the reason I knew a little bit about this is because of the story behind it, which is my son, Travis, is a self-taught student of the revolution. He's a Brandeis student, studied African-American studies, and took every African-American studies course that he could. But there was something about the revolution, and particularly that was important to him and caught his attention. And so he got me. I had to keep up with him. And so I was, you know, sort of fascinated to learn that it was an agrarian revolution, right? It was talking about land reform. It was talking about the rural population. But it was, again, sort of rooted in really trying to empower the rural communities and a bunch of other, but also to wrest control from, obviously, a lot of bad people who had taken the country and were taking it down the road to ruin. But the reason the urban agriculture piece came after, you know, the revolution and after the Soviet Union back then had really sort of, partnered and became the major trade partner of Cuba, brought in large tractors, and literally sort of established a major green, green revolution, right?
Right.
Energy intensive, chemical intensive. As a matter of fact, between the time of the revolution and the collapse of the Soviet bloc in the 1990s, Cuba was per capita a bigger user, heavier user of pesticides and herbicides than the United States, certainly more than any other Latin American country. It was using that model, large machinery, lots of chemical inputs, plant monoculture, right? To sugarcane, tobacco.
Right.
And then came the series of things, right? With the appropriation of land and property, and then the embargo, which then sort of again saw the GDP, it was the GDP then, you know, plummet in Cuba, and then the Soviet Union sort of, you know, becoming its major trade partner and major supplier of those, getting back to import substitutes, the inputs that Cuba needed, right, in order to sustain that, not only the economy, but also for the point here, the agricultural system. And then comes 1989 to 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed and disappeared.
Right. And they are out of luck for everything that was supporting their agriculture, especially
Absolutely.
The small farmers. So it's like, okay, and what do we do now?
They had no chemical inputs.
Right. No
they had
plan
no petroleum.
B. Right.
Right. No plan B. And people were starving. Right. I mean, people were in the immediate aftermath, 15 to 20 pounds the average Cuban was losing. And the government basically said, okay, we got to figure out, and they weren't going to capitulate, they weren't going to go to the U.S. and say, help save us, whatever, and on principle. I mean, you know, we're not going to argue politics, but anyway, that happened. And so here's the important thing, out of necessity, not in this case, not ideology, not in protest of anything, but how do we prevent starvation? How do we grow food without the chemical inputs that we had become dependent upon? What are our options, right? What
right.
do we do? And that, I think there obviously consultation with seniors and elders and there are other countries, right? We're certainly dealing with Cuba, maybe not as much in trade as they want, but this whole notion of organic agriculture.
Right.
And I use that term right now, it's organic. I mean, clearly, because the option was, can we grow food without chemicals? And that notion, though, sort of really over a period of time evolved into something actually more than organic agriculture, because not only did it involve, you know, again, the substitution of chemicals with everything from, you know, manures and composting and permaculture. And it's interesting, many of the concepts that I don't think there are any concepts that would be unfamiliar to, at least, you know, again, the farming concepts or gardening concepts to people in the United States, but they actually went further and realized that they had to come up with a system that not just sort of was a technique for doing this, but really did empower the farmers, right? Because again, also lost were things like perhaps the kind of research that would go on at your extension service, right? How do you do this even more? And so what happened was the farmers became the experimenters. They became the researchers, and they did this on their farms. But they did it, and they shared their research and their results, successful results, with their fellow or colleagues, their other farmers, and farmers protected one another, right? So if things didn't work, you weren't left in the lurch. You took a risk, you tried it, but you were supported by your other farmers. And so this campesina to campesina, farmer to farmer,
right,
strong network grew.
Right.
So there was organizing, there was the technology, there was the organizing, and then there was this, and it's interesting, you mentioned your conversations in Cuba. I was, you know, and now remember, when we were there, it was October 2014, 2 months before Presidents Obama and President Castro made the announcement about, you know, renewing at least talks.
Right.
To rethink.
Right.
So this was still during that period. And so we were kind of surprised at how candid academics, some farmers, economists would talk to us about, and these were their terms, the failure of the socialist experiment in economics. But
okay.
Now that was not, and they said, you know, there were many social gains, the education, right, the science and the agroecology, healthcare, all those things, but the economy, people were hurting, and there's no question. They said, so they were very sort of upfront saying that socialism hasn't worked, but capitalism is not an option for us. We need a new economics. Now that sort of rang true, right? That resonated with us at the, even though I was still on the board of the Schumachers. But here they're searching for a new economics, and so are we. And it is very interesting. And the new economics for them suggested moving, you know, from, you know, use of conventional terms, from the far left, right, sort towards somewhere else, but not, I mean, far right, left, but not to the far right, right? And here we are in our earlier discussions talking about what we need. We've got to avoid the worst-case scenario of climate change, and as Naomi Klein and others have suggested, we cannot do that, at least in the United States, under the current economic system.
Right. It's not going to work. Right.
It's not going to work under the current capitalist system as currently structured. So clearly, you know, again, with this overarching sort of context, there's a need for us to move from the far right somewhere to the middle. I'm not saying we're going to meet, but it is interesting that there is now sort of, you know, not unanimous, probably in either case, but there is clearly a need for the new economics to emerge from its womb in the Berkshires, right, where we're doing some experiments with local currency. But it's got to be something that's embraced and we're taking seriously and think about what are the models? How do we do this? And so I mentioned the farmer to farmer. I mentioned the organic agriculture, the cooperatives, you know, and so that became sort of a major part. You know, where's the balance in the case of Cuba, I'm sort of suggesting, between private ownership but giving some sort of, you know, ownership rights to folks and sharing of the benefits and some types of free market, some exploration of free market. And it's what's really fascinating is that the agricultural sector was the first sector that the Cuban government allowed to sort of take wing and start to experiment with some of these new economic models.
It's a loud thing to listen to. Really pay attention, everyone, because that matters and what it means to the planet. And I just want to read one quick thing because it struck me as it's like we've gone full circle. So when all this happened with the Soviet bloc, and I mean, like you said, no chemical fertilizers or pesticides, no gasoline to fuel the trucks to transport the produce from rural areas to cities. And this is, I took this straight off the website. They met that challenge by rediscovering and reinventing the traditional farming practices of their ancestors, who modeled their farms based on their observations of the natural world. In the process, they developed what amounts to a post-petroleum system of food production called agroecology, a sustainable, resilient approach to growing healthy, nutritious food without adversely impacting terrestrial, aquatic, or atmospheric environments. And Greg, I read that and I'm like, wow, what a great idea.
What a great idea.
There's just no downside to that. And it is going back to what we knew and what was healthy and what was really a connection to the earth. So to me, they were forced to do it, but what they did was go back to the way of their ancestors and looking and observing about the natural world and knowing when things weren't working. And it's an exciting thing to revisit and gives me hope. God knows we need some hope these days.
Absolutely. I know we're getting close to time here, but here's the thing. But they were forced to do it, but now they embrace it.
Yes.
If you read
yes.
some of their literature, you would swear it was written by Rachel Carson or Wendell Berry, right?
Because which is exciting, yes.
Right. They get it. And I just need to point out, though, that you know, again, in right 1 month after the announcement that Cuba and U.S. would enter talks to talk about renewing diplomatic relations. And I will say this, a group formed. It was called the U.S. It is called the U.S. Agriculture Coalition for Cuba, chaired by Cargill, and it's all the big guys.
Wow.
And they are looking to open up. And again, all I'm going to say is, yes, new markets for their products, but I think there is a fear. There is a concern that some of those products will not just be wheat and soybeans, but will be fertilizers, pesticides, and all. And, you know, I have to say that right now Cuba, to a certain extent, for those that are promoting the energy and fossil fuel intensive types of agriculture, let's face it, Cuba is sort of a threat, because it has demonstrated that you can feed your population without their products. Because, you know, Havana and for instance, I think somewhere between 50-70% of their fresh fruits and vegetables come from urban farms, right?
Yes.
So that were established, as you mentioned, during that period when they did not have the petroleum to transport produce from Pernar del Rio, which is, you know, the agricultural land in the far western tip, to the city. So they had to go back to, as you fundamentally saying, well, then we've got to grow as much of the food as we can near the population center, so it's not dependent upon having to be transported.
So
here you got it. Yeah,
here you got it. So it makes me wonder, like, all of my antenna went up about when you have giants like Cargill and all of those people looking. Are you worried about possible negative impacts, and how will what they're doing be protected? Does that make sense? It's like, it's my radar was up. Let's not ruin what they're doing.
You mean with the Cubans?
Yes, with the Cuban side.
Well, here, you know what? First of all, they are very strong. And I just really need to point out, I don't think it's a matter of them needing, and certainly not needing, something like us to protect them, because they have developed such a strong network. That farmer-to-farmer network is over 100,000, I think, farms strong.
Great.
In terms of, my goodness. And it's a system that is you know, where it acknowledges the leadership of women, and it's equitable, and they have really sort of said, we've got something very special here. But that still does not negate the fact they've seen we know what can happen. So one of the things, but I guess this is the caveat real quick, is that even within the government, people are saying, but agriculture is one of those sectors that can produce some new economic development faster than other sectors in Cuba.
And the new,
so there may be, right.
The Schumacher Center for a New Economic will be there helping and watching and spreading the word. And, you know, we are almost out of time, and I want to make sure that people know that we can, you know, to go and to visit your website to learn more about this, because we've got a really great following all over the country, and it's centerforneweconomics.org, and it doesn't have an A, it's centerforneweconomics.org.
That's right.
And you can find out a lot of really incredibly important and relevant to all of us information there, and read more about Greg and his impressive history. And, you know, Greg, there's I want you to get the final word, and there isn't going to be one, but it feels like when I read about your background, you were being groomed for a very important position in this role. It's a really important one and quite impressive. So I bless your journey, and thanks for showing up in my world and for being at Bioneers, another great organization. And clearly we'll have to have you back, because we only covered half my questions, and I loved it. Everything you shared to me was so relevant. When the guest is talking, I'm listening, and you had such great things to say. Next week, Jason Tankersley sharing with us about Tank Screen Stuff, a local wonder. In April 30th, Dave Hutchins from Tucson Electric Power Company. Make it a great green week, everybody. Greg Watson, I'm grateful for your presence on the planet and in the life of Mrs. Green's World. Thank you.
Thank you.